From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour comes from Ireland all the way to Rochester, and it comes with the question, why would an Irish filmmaker become fascinated by the story of Rochester as a city of photography? You could certainly understand why a local filmmaker would want to tell Rochester's story in this light, but an Irish filmmaker? We're about to get the backstory in a moment. The film is called Photo City. It's a documentary that makes its premiere tomorrow night at the Little Theater as part of the One Take Film Festival. John Murphy is one of the co-writers, editors, and co-directors of Photo City. His team spent a lot of time in Rochester, and their film attempts to paint a picture by stitching together the story of all kinds of modern photographers. A newspaper photographer. A photographer who's hired by women who want nude images of themselves. A nature photographer. And more. What does all of this tell us about ourselves and about Rochester? You can find out by checking out the documentary at The Little and decide for yourself. But first, John Murphy, all the way from Ireland. Thanks for taking the time to join us on the program. How are you?
I'm very good. Delighted to join you guys.
Well, why don't you start by giving us the backstory on how this film came together at all? I find it fascinating that it was made. I find it fascinating because someone like you from Ireland would take to such personal stories and the personal stories that make up a personal story about a city. So tell us how it came together.
Well, I've always been interested in photography, and I work as a film and television editor in Ireland, and I kind of had a ritual that every time I kind of got paid, and frequently when you work in the arts, you don't get paid on time. So when I get a big check, I would go down and buy a photography book from some of the secondhand bookstores or bookstores around town. And that became kind of a ritual, and I always just used to pick up kind of photography books. I can't take a photograph particularly well, but I always had a big kind of passion for it. And I came across the story of kind of Rochester. Around the time of Kodak bankruptcy, there was quite a few photography books released on that kind of topic. And I came across a couple, and in particular one by a Swiss photographer called Kodak City. And I ended up kind of chatting with her, with Catherine, and I just kind of read about it and read the backstory about it and thought there's a documentary film in this. And I didn't really think too much about it again for a couple of years until there was a documentary scheme here through the Irish Arts Council looking for kind of films about the arts and ones that might take a kind of an unorthodox approach to things. And I felt that this could be kind of the right thing to do with that. And we applied. I asked Trailock, my co-director, to come on board to kind of help out with areas I was deficient in. And we applied for it and we got the funding. And yeah, then all of a sudden we were heading to Rochester.
Some of these stories, the personal stories in this film, are very much tied to Rochester. Some are the types of stories that you can find in almost any city. And I'm curious to know how you chose your interview subjects and what you hope that their stories stitched together will say about Rochester.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing that you look for when you're kind of casting a film casting a documentary film is that you're looking for people that will kind of connect. So on a very basic level, we were just trying to find people who would resonate irregardless of what their story told you about Rochester. But very much part of our process when looking for people is, well, what does this tell us about kind of the broader story? But first and foremost, our criteria was, will people connect with this on a personal level? And if they connect with it on a personal level, they'll see the broader story as well. So we kind of, my co-director Trailock was living in Montreal at the time, and our producer was living in New York City. So they were able to go down. So they went down and kind of spent a couple of days meeting people, chatting to people. And both of them would have a good history in kind of how to cast documentaries for television and for film. So they were able to kind of draw up a short list of people. And then we also allowed for when we would arrive to shoot a certain amount of room for kind of magic to happen, and kind of just, you know, that you might meet people when you're in the when you're in a place for longer than a couple of days. You generally tend to kind of get to know the place and you get a better sense of it. So we left room in the schedule for that to happen, and a few that and that did happen in a few cases, you know. But yeah, overall, then how it would stitch together. I think if you go to any place and interview people, you get a sense of the where they're from through that person. So we were very conscious that we didn't want to tell a history of Rochester or a history of Kodak or anything like that. We kind of wanted to let that kind of emerge through people's own personal stories.
There is there's a moment in the film in which I'm trying to remember if Steve Sasson himself said it or if it was said around part of the interviews. For our listeners who don't know, Steve Sasson, who has been on this program a number of times, is often credited with being the inventor of the digital camera. And he was a Kodak scientist, is a very warm and engaging guy. And Steve essentially invented the digital camera as an employee of Kodak. And so there is this narrative that says, how did the company that invented the digital camera get beat by the digital camera? And there's a moment in the film, and I don't remember if it was Steve or somebody else, who says, you know, well, the narrative is not exactly true, that Kodak was just fat and happy and asleep at the wheel. And I wonder how you personally feel about that. Is that narrative, because that narrative is pretty common here now, your film at least allows for a little pushback, and do you personally think that that narrative is fair?
Yeah, well, we were very conscious that we didn't want to kind of, we weren't doing an expose or a business piece about what kind of, it was very much about people's own opinions on things. And we let people say, you know, some people said that it was gross mismanagement. Some people said it was, you know, it was Todd from the Eastman House who said that line about that they were asleep at the wheel. I think it's a confluence of different things that happened. I think, yes, they probably could have been, I think Kodak probably could have been smarter. I think from reading up on it, you know, obviously I'm not on the ground in the way that your listeners would be, but reading up on it, my own feeling on it was that perhaps they kind of diversified a little too much in the 80s instead of, in terms of buying chemical, you know, buying lots of different kind of into other areas, and they should have just focused on what they were good at and finding a way to make that work, and also seeing which way the wind was going as well. So I do think they were probably negligent. I would say that sometimes just kind of time moves on as well, you know, like things that were popular 50 years ago aren't, things that are popular now aren't going to be popular, aren't going to be big business in 50 years' time, you know?
So, sure.
It's hard to know.
And we're talking to John Murphy, who is the co-director of the documentary film called Photo City, which debuts at the One Take Film Festival on April 19th. There's an encore on April 21st. So Thursday the 19th, 6:30 p.m., Saturday the 21st, 1:15 p.m. And John and his co-director will participate in a Q&A session following each of those screenings as part of the One Take Film Festival. There is a moment, there is a sort of a section in the film that turns its lens to race. You talk to Carvin Eisen, among others, and I'm curious to know from your position as co-director, you know, you got a lot of choices in how you tell these stories, and Rochester has had a history of race being an issue. But in a film about Photo City, not just about Rochester, but about its history as a photo city, why did you choose to take on race?
That's a tough question to answer. I think it would have been remiss of us not to, in kind of some way or shape or form. I also think it's important to look at the consequences of kind of corporate responsibility towards the community. I think that's kind of more so what I was interested in necessarily than kind of race relations. I think that kind of ties into it. But Yeah, we felt like we had to kind of go there. It's an area of it just took us from as outsiders. Sometimes you can kind of see things, and that kind of struck us that there the poverty line was kind of there, and it broke along kind of racial lines a lot of the time. Now, it's kind of easy for us to say as outsiders, but at the same time, that did feel like that was something we could kind of address. But also, you know, Carvin says in the film that we also wanted to draw kind of attention to other things that were happening in America now through that. So it allowed us an opportunity to do that, I think.
Yeah, and to parallel in some ways to what's happening 50 years after the so-called Rochester race riots, or at least the decade, 54 years now. And I do think the film leaves viewers with an important impression, which is historically true, which is that when many of these black families moved to Rochester, this was one of the most booming and successful times for the city and for a single company that largely just chose not to hire people of color. And so in many ways, I just want to applaud you for being willing to take that on. I think to elide that would have been easier, to omit that would have been easier. But I think you took on a hard and important part as part of the film, and it's by no means the core of the film or the only part of the film. But I applaud you for doing that. Was there a discussion that you had with the co-creators of this film that, you know, does this take us too far afield? Or in your words, I think you just said you felt like you had to do it, but there must have been at least some discussion on does this fit or is this the right way to go?
I don't think we ever really had any doubt in our kind of minds about it. I think once we decided to do it, we kind of knew that this was the right thing to do. You know, the nature of how the film is structured is very much kind of a tapestry of different life experiences, and we kind of felt that would be this was a strand of that we couldn't kind of ignore. You know, so we felt confident that it would fit. We felt confident that, like you said, that it wouldn't overpower it either, because that would be a worry too. Sometimes you can kind of take on hefty issues like this, and sometimes they can overpower a film, but we didn't feel like that would be the case, and I don't think it does either, you know.
Let me talk to you a little bit about what you want to leave viewers with. I guess I'll start with a question and more broadly, and then we'll narrow it a little bit here. Broadly speaking, viewers of Photo City, when they go to see this documentary as part of the One Take Film Festival, what would you like them to emerge from the theater having either learned or felt or experienced?
Well, obviously, screening a film in Rochester is going to be interesting. So we'd like to think that I'd like to think that the Rochester audience would feel that we were fair. And I'd like to think that they would see part of themselves through the film. I'd also like to think that people, and this doesn't just apply to Rochester people, but I think I'd like people to come away from it with a sense of the power of community and the power of art and the power of living a creative life. Because fundamentally, that was our main thing with the film, is that we wanted to show what the value is in living a creative life and how Rochester was a place that kind of fosters that and has done for 50-odd years, so, or 100 years. So, I'd like them to kind of come away thinking, placing value on those things. I guess, yeah.
And I guess I want to conclude with this then. If a Rochesterian had made the same kind of film, Photo City, and told the story of Kodak and a city sort of the same way, I wonder if it would not have concluded, and I don't want to give too much away, and listeners, you've got two great opportunities to see Photo City yourself coming up here, and to hear from John, and to join that conversation right after you see this documentary as part of the One Take Film Festival. I'm not sure a Rochesterian would have been as sanguine, as optimistic, or at least, I don't know if positive is a little bit too saccharine a word, but you know, it a lot of Rochesterians have come to feel a little bit grim about what happened to Kodak, the loss of all of those jobs, what it means for the city going forward, the challenges in sort of reconstructing an economy, and there is a perspective that maybe comes from an outsider, like you say, who is learning the story, observing, spending time here, reading, but didn't grow up here to feel that disappointment and pain. And so I guess I wonder if you think some Rochesterians are going to think, well, these folks are too optimistic, or if you're going to think, they're going to think, look, it's good to get that outsider perspective, because sometimes we get so kind of inward looking and maybe a little cynical or down that it's valuable to have a perspective of someone telling these stories who didn't grow up here.
Well, I grew up in Ireland in the 80s, where factory closures were kind of a common thing. Now, perhaps not on the same scale as Kodak, but, you know, there was, where I come from, there was a big sugar beet factory that closed. There was a big computer firm that were based in Galway that closed. And they're devastating things for communities. And I think they take a long time for communities to kind of process it. When we were heading over, we kind of expected that people would be a lot angrier and people would be a lot more frustrated with what happened with Kodak. But what we actually found, we were genuinely taken aback by it, but was that people were, broadly speaking, extremely optimistic about the future and very extremely proud of their town and where it came from and where it was going. And I think the film reflects that a little. I don't think we don't shy away from saying we're not overtly positive about it. But I think hope's a beautiful thing, and I think perhaps we kind of focus on that a little bit more than nasal gaving, you know. And I think sometimes you're right. Sometimes it does take an outsider to kind of say, you don't need to look at your shoes. You can, look above, look at the sky, you know?
Sure. And I think that this is where it's really universal, in that, wherever you grew up in Ireland, there are tourists who are going to, my 6-year-old son's going to Ireland for a week this summer with his very good friend here in Rochester, whose parents are Irish, and he's very excited. And I'm sure there are some people who grew up in, I think they're in County Mayo, and they're going to climb Kilpatrick, and they're going to do fun stuff. And I think, and I'm sure there are some locals in Ireland who think, well, what's the big deal? What are you coming across halfway across the world for to come here? In the same way that Rochesterians might get down on their city, or everybody sort of has, I won't say everybody, but people, I think, generally speaking, might miss what is beautiful or just, sort of real and not as negative about their own place, compared to what an outsider who gets a chance to experience it. So I think there's something really valuable there, and I think the film has an element of that, and I'm grateful for that. So John, thanks for taking the time, and I know Rochester is excited to get a chance to talk to you. Are you excited about One Take? Linda Maroney is wonderful. It's a great group. How do you feel about the film festival?
I'm very excited about it. I'm very excited to go back to Rochester and to kind of see everyone that we helped us out when we made the film. But also, I'm just really excited to go to, I love going to documentary film festivals. So I'm excited about seeing some of the wonderful films that they have on. There's some absolute belters on. So I'm really looking forward to kind of catching a couple of those.
Very good. John Murphy, right? He's a co-writer, co-director of Photo City, debuts at One Take Film Festival coming up on the 19th, Thursday, Saturday again. So Thursday, 6:30, Saturday, 1:15 p.m., and John and his co-director participating in a Q&A session at the Little following each screening. Check out more online, and we'll get a short break and come back with more conversation. But John, thanks for taking the time, and we appreciate it very much.
Cheers.
Next on Connections, our studio panel takes a look at the film and what it means to be a photo city. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we're joined by former Ambassador Peter Romero, a career diplomat who says we need diplomacy now more than ever. He's in Rochester to talk about the United States' relationships with North Korea, the European Union, and how the vacancies in the State Department could impact foreign policy. Then in our second hour, award-winning local poets discuss their art, how poetry can give marginalized groups a voice, and more. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In studio, let's welcome back Linda Maroney, filmmaker and director and programmer for the One Take Film Festival. And a 3-year Irish resident yourself?
I was. I know. Listening to John Murphy, I think my brogue is going to come
I want to know if you did you get any accent when you were living there?
Oh, I totally. I had a West Cork accent, so it was a real sing-song accent. So I came back. I was 13. I was awkward, and everyone stared at me in class. And until I lost it, I stopped.
West Cork. So the sing-song is a did you know?
Oh, it's worse than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
what is a belter, by the way? Because John said there's lots of belters in this festival.
Like really good things that he's looking forward to seeing. Yeah.
Is that that's a common Irish
yeah,
term?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it a bar term?
Belters. Jack Garner is a retired national film critic for Gannett Newspapers in studio with us. And Jack is going to be hosting the Talk Back on Saturday.
Right. And I love the film. I thought it was a fascinating cultural history of our town.
Oh, great to have you back here. Thank you, Jack. Mm-hmm. And one of the people featured in the film is Arlene Thaler, a socially engaged photojournalist. We've talked to her on this program before, and it'll be good to kind of explore your work and how you see it in the context of this film. So welcome back to you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Linda, what's the short answer to... I've talked to several people who have seen this film now, and I just asked them, what do you think the goal of the film is? Like, what's the takeaway? What's the film about? What's the short answer for you?
For me, it's where we are now. I mean, I think most of us know what the history is of Kodak, the history of the town. I moved here in 2006, and I think, you know, listening to your conversation before, at that point, things were still pretty ugly, and people were really angry still at that point. I don't see as much anger in the community anymore. But I think it's really about where things are now. You know, there's still this period of transition, and who in our community is still creating with this art form that was really started here.
Okay. Jack, what do you think? What's the short description of the film for you?
I think it's more of a cultural history of what developed in Rochester, and not so much an economic history. Regarding that last question that you asked, John, we are aware of the really sad scenario of what happened when all those jobs were lost and Kodak lost its impact. And I've been here for almost half a century. So I do remember when auto dealerships would be ready for the Kodak bonus days, when they get guys coming to buy a whole car based on their bonus. And I remember the power of that business. But what this film shows us is do take some kind of heart out of it, in that it inspired in this community a love of photography that continues on. It echoes on down their ears, and it doesn't matter necessarily that Kodak is no longer the number one, number two, or number 10 employer in this town, whatever they are, because what does matter in terms of this film is the cultural sensation of making photographs and what can be done with photographs and the wide range of photography. And it even doesn't matter necessarily that it's changed the digital. The fact remains that pictures are taken, and it's just sometimes that they're taken in a different way than they used to be, but they're still pictures that tell stories and that have an emotional impact. And the range of photography that they go through as they look at this was fascinating. One thing I loved in this film, though, about the old days, I loved Carvin Eisen's quote, which is so true, that in the mid-20th century, Rochester was the Silicon Valley of America. And that's true. I mean, when I came here in 70, and that 1970, and it was already starting to fade. But the fact remains, we had Bausch & Lomb, we had Kodak, and we had Xerox, the three great image companies in the world, all right here. And the fact that made this the image city. And today we still are the image city. They tend to call it in this film Photo City, but it's the image city.
I want to highlight for me what the main takeaway is from this film, which was there is a guy in this town who takes portraits of women when they're nude, and he doesn't even wear a shirt when he's shooting those. I would at least wear a shirt if I'm shooting nude women.
I will tell you, though, about those pictures. That's Frank DeBlase we're talking
and
about.
And he plays by his own rules, and no one is going to challenge Frank.
He's got a great wife, Deb, and I've always wondered how Deb puts up with him shooting those pictures, and now I know how. She's there, too.
Oh, the things you did learn in John Murphy's film. It's called Photo City. And before I turn to Arlene for some of her story, let's do this. Let's sort of get that main that question we were just talking about out of the way, because this is not a film about the economic history of Kodak. But there are some competing ideas in the film that I am kind of curious about. So first, let's listen to a clip from the film. This is Todd Gustafson, who is a George Eastman House's curator of technology, talking about Kodak. Let's listen.
You're looking at a company that had a huge run, maybe the most successful run of any company, basically making the same product for a 100-year period. It's not as cut and dried as most people think. I mean, most people think the Eastman Kodak Company was a sweep at the switch, you know, fat, dumb, and happy, if you would. And that really isn't the case.
That's definitely the narrative, and he's saying it's not the case. Joseph Morinelli was a former Kodak employee who had this to say about it.
In relation to the company, what I think of now is, I believe it, mismanagement, inability to see the future the correct way. We all knew digital was coming, and we all saw the downsizing and the lack of product changes and all the different things that were going on, but we still feel that management would have handled it better. Things could be different today.
All right, and now lastly, I want to listen to Max Schulte, who is certainly a friend of ours and a photojournalist at the Democrat and Chronicle and does wonderful work as the lead photographer there. This is kind of a coda on that question indirectly, but I think it's interesting in sort of juxtaposing it with what you just heard, two competing viewpoints on the narrative of Kodak. Here's Max talking about what he sees today.
There's almost kind of this rebuilding of Rochester taking place. If you look around, there's development happening in some of these larger office buildings that were occupied by Bausch and Lomb. You know, they're putting in a residential and other commercial space for people to work in. The largest warehouse that Kodak had is now being used to process and package beats. You know, Rochester can adapt, Rochester can change. Look at our stories, look at our pictures, look at our videos, and look at the revitalization down here. It's good to be part of maybe changing the conversation.
This is where I would say to Max, are you being a little too sanguine? I mean, there's definitely some things happened at the former plant spaces, but there's a lot of empty space. There's a lot of sadness and empty parking lots, aren't there, Jack?
Yeah, Kodak Park is certainly not what it once was in any way, with either Kodak or somebody else in the buildings. But there is some vitalization up there. I love what they did to the Kodak Theater, making it more accessible to the community up on the ridge. But still, there's a lot of empty space. And, you know, it's an undeniably sad scenario, but it happens. It happens in all kinds of industries and all kinds of cities. Things change. Hell, we used to be the Flower City, F-L-O-U-R. We're no longer the Flower City. We're the Flower City, F-L-O-W-E-R, because we have a lilac festival. I mean, these things change. And I just think the adaptability is... I mean, you can moan and groan about the fact that, in my opinion, for example, Kodak was short-sighted on this issue of digital. They looked at it as a cutting into their sales next month instead of thinking what's going to happen in a decade. And I think that was a real problem. But that's past. We do have to find some way to move on. And if it happens to be beats that we're canning or whatever it is, so be it. You know?
Or a performing arts center in part of it, beats in part of it.
Yeah.
Though I do think, and Steve Sasson's in this film, he's one of my favorite people in this town. He's such a smart guy.
Right.
Largely credited as the inventor of the digital camera. You can try all you want, but if you are the company that invented digital and then you got beat by digital, that's going to be part of the narrative.
Especially over 20 years. This wasn't like last week.
I know. But again, let's get away from that because that's not the core of the film. Let's set that aside. Let me grab one phone call and then I want to shift to really what the heart of the film is, these fascinating personal stories and these portraits of people like Arlene. But Jim in Rochester wants to jump in. Go ahead, Jim.
Good afternoon, everyone. I know everybody's knocking Kodak, but I want to make one statement, and I think the facts bear me out. Kodak had probably the best research laboratory in the country for a company of size. And the scientists in that, and the mathematicians and the engineers did a remarkable job of coming up with all these new innovative ways of imaging. We call it photographic science. And let me give you an example. The people who invented the digital, it's my understanding that if it was 40 microns in one pixel, digital measured in pixel. For silver haloid, it was 0.5 micron. That's what gives you the quality and the detailed photographic image that you see. And the scientists in that research lab right there on Lake Avenue had already figured that out. And it's a real tragedy. But the question is, where do we go from here? And it's my understanding that a big merchant bank out of Wall Street, I think it was Goldman Sachs, found out that Kodak had all that all that capacity up there sitting empty doing nothing. We call that non-performing assets, and they're now growing marijuana plants up there because it's dust-free, particle-free, et cetera, et cetera, and they're shipping it to other sections of the country. So it's a real tragedy that what happened. But I don't know what the Photronics area is going to bring forth, but we'll see. but that photographic imaging. In fact, if you go on Ridge Road West, there's a two-story wheel where they used to make that film, the emulsion they call it, okay? Can you imagine the energy that it takes to move a two-story iron wheel? And I was told they had a three-story wheel in there where they make that film from scratch, emulsion and all the glue that's held that film together. It's unbelievable. So it was a real tragedy, a real tragedy. I would say you could say it was the management of the company that didn't have the foresight to see what was coming down the pipe, and everyone else jumped on digital. Even though digital has his scientific shortcomings, because ABC had a movie, they re-showed Star Wars, Steven Spielberg, the director, and he was sold on digital. And the quality of that film had deteriorated so much that ABC said, we'll never run it again. Hmm. So Kodak Park is making more film for Hollywood than they've ever, because the quality and the imaging is 20 to 30 times better than digital.
Well, Jim, thank you for the phone call. There's a lot of scientific aspects of that phone call that make me realize I am not smart enough to hang with parts of this conversation. But Jack, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
I just want to jump in on one point that he made right at the very end there. By the way, it's not Spielberg with Star Wars. We know it's Lucas, but those two guys get mixed up a lot.
They do.
But the question of them making more film is not exactly right, because here's the difference. When digital started to come in filmmaking, they would shoot the films on digital because they could do the special effects easier, and then they would convert them to film for the 1,000 prints that would get distributed. But when they forced all the theaters throughout America to convert to digital, that's no longer the case. Now, it's reverse has happened. Filmmakers realize films look good shot on film, so they'll have one film that they shoot it on. They'll convert it to 1,000 digital. Well, not exactly that, but they show it on 1,000 screens with digital, so it's reversed itself because there's no projectors anymore. I mean, they've got them all out of the theaters, and you can't get them to go back now after everybody spent tons of money, including the little, which had to have a fundraising campaign to get the cameras in. So that's the difference now. So they are making film, but nothing like they used to.
And let me grab one more call on that subject. Gary in Greece says that how we look at Kodak is generational. Is that right, Gary?
Yeah, thanks. I'm the same generation as Jack, and my interest was piqued when I heard Jack say it was sad. A couple of years ago, and I don't know if you're familiar with 585 magazine.
Yep.
But they did a story, and they interviewed 20 and 30 and early 30-year-olds as to why they were moving back to Rochester. And Jack should remember this. You know, 10, 15 years ago, we couldn't get young people to stay here because there was, quote unquote, nothing to do, and the city offered nothing. And it was kind of a wake-up call for me. Time after time, what these young people said was, of all things, you know, since Kodak left, this is such a much nicer place to live. Kodak was choking us off culturally and with the arts. Think about when Kodak was here, what people did. They worked downtown, they went to the suburbs, and they just kind of lived these segregated lives. Now that Kodak's gone, there's a lot of entrepreneurship, some more creative thinking, you know, et cetera.
Couldn't we have done both?
Well, and to that point, it wasn't just Kodak. I mean, we see this in industries throughout the country. But if we're just dealing with this, you know, I'm sad I'm not a teenager anymore. But I'm glad I'm growing up. And I think maybe since Kodak left, that Rochester's starting to grow up a little bit.
Hmm.
Thanks.
Gary, thanks for the phone call. Do you see, Linda, this is what this film has already got people talking.
That's what a great documentary should do. It's perfect.
And as a reminder, Gary, thanks. I'll let our panel respond to that in just a second. But as a reminder, that kind of discussion is part of what this festival's about, because John Murphy and his co-director will be in attendance. They will participate in an audience Q&A following each screening of Photo City. The first is tomorrow night, 6:30 p.m. at the Little, Saturday, 1:15 p.m. And those talkbacks are, you know, really part of the core of this.
Really, really part of it. The screening tomorrow night is going to have Steve Carter from Explore Rochester, mm-hmm. So a much younger demographic. leading that Q&A afterwards. So we have different people each night.
much younger? Come on.
Jack, you could have just said younger.
And then hobbling up on Saturday will be the old man.
How about I feel old compared to Steve Carter? He makes me feel old. That's more along the lines where I was going with that. But we have music before the films, and our house band, Guy Higgins, had written a whole album about Kodak, which I've never heard. So he's actually going to be performing it before both screenings.
By the way, Jack, what do you think of Gary's point that Rochester had to grow up a little and Kodak's demise helped that?
I don't connect the dots. I mean, I think what happened in our town did happen. It's happened in a lot of communities. It is true. There's more vibrancy. I really sense it. I've been here 50 years. I really sense the vibrancy. I've had all these apartments and things that are now being leased downtown and all the old buildings that have been converted into homes and the return to town and the fact that the Jazz Festival, for example, is still going off the charts and all these exciting things are happening in this community is true. I'm not quite sure understand why the demise of Kodak caused that to happen. But whether it did or not, the fact remains that it was, there was the dictate of the times and of the scenario of how things were done that it happened. So it's happened and now we just have to move on.
The new film is a documentary called Photo City, and I want to turn to Arlene Thaler, who is one of the people profiled in this film, in this documentary. Under the name Photo City, maybe in modern America, a city that can really be inextricably tied to one moniker like that is not a good thing. Maybe that means that your economy is so tied up in one thing that if that thing collapses, you're in trouble. And so maybe it's a good thing that we are a flower city, F-L-O-W-E-R, mm-hmm. that we are going to be a tech city, maybe. We are a tech city probably right now. We're a jazz city in some ways. Maybe it's good to be diverse. But let me ask you, as a photographer, do you think of Rochester as a photo city?
I think of America as a photo country. I feel like everybody's photographing right now with our smartphones. You can't get away from it. It's everywhere. Social media, you're speaking of the digital. For me, I'm completely digital, and I was trained in film, and if I had to go back to film, I don't think I would budget-wise be able to do it. And I think that's what so many people in Rochester are photographing now. It's not just people who can do it because they can afford the film. It's anyone who can afford a phone is photographing, and it's not just Rochester, it's every city in the country, around the world. It's a photographic world right now more than it's ever been. So for me, I have family members a brother and a brother-in-law that worked at Kodak. And I think about back in the day when you graduate from high school, you get a job at Kodak and you're going to be there till you retire. I wonder if I'm 50 and I wonder if that was me back then, I would have chosen that path. And that creativity, I wouldn't have chosen the path of creativity and artistry that I had. If there was that big industry here that we all went to work at and that. So I think I used to think of Rochester as a photo city. I don't so much anymore. And I think it is because we've got so many festivals and so many things that highlight so many different other things outside of photography.
Okay. And when it comes to your work now, the film profiles some of that work, and as I introduced you as a socially engaged photojournalist, how do you describe your own work, Arlene?
My work's changed so much since the film, since I met John and Traylock. My work is socially engaged. The work that I do out in the streets is bridging, I would say it's building bridges, meeting people in the community that are marginalized. I used to say I was able to give them a voice, but I don't really think I'm giving them a voice because they have their own voices, more of a conduit to get their voice out there so that agencies and people that can help see the images and say, wow, I can come in and do something to help these people. Over the last year I was a resident artist for Flower City Art Center, and in that time I had worked on a documentary on plastic waste. And I can see now today where I'm at is pulling completely, actually I think I'm retiring from social reportage with people and becoming more of an environmental photographer of people's waste. That's grabbed me in a way I never thought the way people do and still do. It's what I do.
Before I grab Patricia on the next phone call, let me just ask you what it meant to you to be chosen to be one of the photographers profiled in this film.
It was amazing. They contacted me through my website, so that someone Googled and that it popped up. That was pretty exciting. And again, it's back to the digital thing. My whole outlet with my work is digital. you know, if it's the internet and, you know, I'm easily taking the photo, putting it on the internet, updating my website, and then someone to see it around the world and come here and photograph me photographing, it was pretty special.
Jack?
It occurred to me, we've been talking about how the Kodak's effect on this being Photo City and making photography a big deal. I'm wondering if just the idea of digital alone is a factor, because am I right in assuming that at least at some level, photography is a heck of a lot easier today because of digital?
Absolutely.
It used to be in the days of print, you also had to be a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people, I think they got stopped short of walking in the dark room.
Absolutely.
So the chemistry aspect is gone. And also, you don't have to worry about wasting film. If anything, you shoot too much and have to edit back. But still, like you said, anybody today, like Orson Welles once said this about movies. He says, today anybody can make a movie. It's making a good movie. And for you, I would say anybody can take a photo and just make it a good one, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, careful there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not diminish the highest level of work. What I would say about photographers is this. The barrier of entry is lower, but the still top shelf photography
quality.
Is special.
Yeah. No, you got to have a great eye and an artistic sensibility and an ability to also get to the core of the story. I agree with all that. That's for sure.
Yeah, but you're right. The barrier of entry is smaller. In fact, I think Max Schulte says in the film at one point, if I had to go back and use film, I would throw my camera in the lake and go sell shoes or something. You know, just mm-hmm. not happening. So it is very, very different today. Here's something else that comes up in the film. It's the subject of race, and Patricia in Fairport wants to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Patricia.
Hello. I'll be very interested in how this film handles that subject. In 1955, I graduated from high school in Rochester, a city high school. And one day after final exams, my friend Doris and I decided, hey, let's go downtown and get a job. Her father worked at Kodak. My father worked at Kodak. So she went to Camera Works. I went to Kodak office. And within 10 minutes, we each had a job. And we met each other at an appointed place and had lunch together. And I worked as a messenger girl, my first job there. So I had access to all 19 floors of Kodak office. And very naively, I hadn't really thought about race. I knew that Rochester was extremely segregated and that State Street was one of the lines of demarcation for that. But I was still shocked that there wasn't one person of color working on any of those 19 floors. In fact, I then became a file clerk and worked in the basement, and we shared space with the maintenance people. Now, the maintenance people were Hungarian refugees. There had been some kind of a revolt in Hungary, and these were white men who couldn't speak English, and a lot of churches had taken over helping them, and they got jobs at Kodak. Down in the office. And the other discriminatory thing that I found out, one of my best friend's fathers could not get a job at Kodak in the late 30s because he was Italian. And he changed his name to a more English-sounding name and ended up becoming an executive at Kodak. But that's a secret I will never tell. Mm. Anyhow, I wanted to comment. Now, this is a very long time ago, 1955, but that's how things were then. And I'm not at all surprised that when 1964 came, there was that terrible riot. And I hope they'll mention Saul Alinsky and his work in trying to get things turned around the beginning. And I think we're still suffering from that discrimination that occurred way back then.
Patricia, thank you. It's I really appreciate the phone call, the history and the insight, and I can tell you that the film Carvin Eisen is the voice that kind of leads us through those discriminatory practices, the racial tension that absolutely exploded in 1964, and the film doesn't shy away from at least asking the viewers to think about if we can draw links to today. And so I thought Carvin Eisen, Jack, I thought was a powerful voice in that film.
No, he really is. He's been that way all along, and not just in this movie. He's led this fight to get Frederick Douglass statues around town. He made a great documentary himself about lynching and the horrible tragedy of lynching in America. So he's been a strong voice all along. I'm not necessarily sure I would specifically blame Kodak. I don't mean to be the rose-tinted glasses here on this panel, but I think any industry in 1955, almost any industry, except maybe a couple exceptions, but you'd mostly find that kind of hiring going on, which is a tragedy.
Or not hiring. And I'll blame Kodak because they were the biggest.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They should have led the way instead of being behind, you know, everything else. I don't know, maybe the car industry. I know a lot of people came up from the Mississippi Delta and that area and
Absolutely.
Worked in Detroit.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the car industry was a leader in that field. I'm not sure. But Carvin is a real good voice for this in the film and addresses it really well. I can't remember whether it was in this film or somewhere else where I recently learned an interesting fact. You know who the most photographed man of the 19th century was? Who, Linda?
Frederick Douglass.
Even more than Lincoln. I said, maybe in the world. And they says, well, there's Queen Victoria. but still, isn't that amazing? I don't know. It has nothing to do with anything, but it's just interesting. That
is certainly an interesting fact. The film's only 75 minutes long or so. It's svelte. It moves briskly. There's going to be a lot of time for conversation after the two screenings that are coming up. The first tomorrow night after the screening at 6:30 at the Little, and then Saturday, 1:15 p.m. Let me ask Linda Maroney, who's not only helping put together the One Take Film Festival, but a filmmaker in her own right, and an excellent filmmaker in her own right. You know, you've got John and his team from Ireland. Of all places, you've got Irish filmmakers making a film about Kodak. And I thought that conversation that I had with him earlier this hour was interesting in that he is, I thought, very humble about saying, you know, I'm not the foremost historian on Rochester. But clearly when he came and wanted to do a film like Photo City, he heard enough to tell him, we've got to do it. We have to tackle race. We cannot leave race out. And the filmmaking choice was, it's not going to be a white guy narrating a film about the section. It's voices. It's Arlene's voice. It's Frank DeBlaise's voice. It's Carvin Eisen's voice. And allowing them to tell the story, I thought, made that for a more authentic vehicle. What did
Absolutely.
You think?
It's a tapestry, really, of our community and voices within our community. You know, going back to what you were saying before, I think a filmmaker from this community would have made a very different movie. And I think at some point there should really be made a Kodak, you know, the quintessential documentary on Kodak, sort of.
It's going to be you. No. Put your hand up.
I'm not ready for that one. But I think this is a different thing. You know, this film was also finished about a year ago. I was trying to get this film to come last year for the festival, and they were really, really concerned. You know, this is a film about a community that they don't live in. And as a programmer, I'm constantly tracking movies. So it literally took me a year to get a screener from them for this movie because they were so concerned about how it might be seen by people in Rochester.
Interesting. Jack.
I went online and found that it has been at a couple other festivals, including two that I know of, at least two in Ireland. I'd be curious to know what they think abroad of the film and of Rochester. But
we should go over for the next one.
I think we need to check it out.
Road trip.
Yeah, there's
Road
a
trip.
Lot of tweets regarding that. I think that was the Cork Film Festival, and people were tweeting all sorts of stuff about the folks in Rochester, and it was all very positive.
By the way, I want to throw in here right now, though, that my real formal name is John Kane Murphy Garner. From County Cork.
What part?
County Cork. I don't know where beyond
okay.
that. Murphy.
Because you're from West Cork?
West Cork.
But Murphy, I got to say, is the Smith of Ireland. So I doubt there's real connections with John Murphy and me. But you never know. You never know.
A couple minutes left. Let me ask the photographer on the pedal, Arlene Thaler. Have you seen the film?
Yes, I have.
What did you take away from seeing other photographers and the way they worked? Everybody's got different approaches and different lines of work with it. What did you think?
I love the diversity so much. I am inspired by everybody's vision and what they bring to it. And I think what I love the most is we're talking about race, too, is that was a part of this. I'm working right now on a project with the Open Door Mission, and I'm photographing a woman of color who lives in her car, and she lives in the car with her 18-year-old son. So I met them at Russell Station one day to hang out and photograph on the beach and brought my gear to photograph her. And I just had this moment of, this isn't my story. How can I photograph that? So her 18-year-old son, you know, I asked, are you interested in photography? He took the camera. He's been photographing the story ever since. And I think that's an epiphany I had of, we can tell people's stories as far as photojournalism goes. We'll speak for myself with the photojournalism part of it. But if we can give the cameras to people who although they may have a phone, they may not have access to understanding how to take a good photo, and they can tell their own story. So that's been a shift in my work, is getting the community to tell their own story visually. So I'm really excited about that. But I love Rochester for it's. There's so many amazing artists here, and when John was talking about artists in Rochester, it's a really great. It's very conducive. Rochester is to. For an artist to live. You've got Made on State and other buildings that are popping up for the artist. There's lots of spaces that are affordable. So, yeah, I really like seeing the diversity.
For some reason, what you just said, first of all, your humility in not wanting to center yourself when you're talking about telling people stories when they are been marginalized, when they've been really struggling, is really admirable and beautiful. Contrast that to a bunch of photos we saw last summer when Mark Zuckerberg was going through the Midwest saying that he wanted to meet the people and tell their stories, and every photo had him with somebody in it.
Yeah.
Okay, you're not the story, Mark. Yeah. Arlene is not only not in the photos, but there are times where you hand your camera to somebody else.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Online where can people see more of your work?
ArleneThalerPhotography.com.
And spell it for me.
ArleneThaler Photography.com.
Okay, ArleneThalerPhotography.com. You can see her profiled among several local photographers. She's in Photo City, the new documentary, tomorrow night, 6:30 at The Little, or Saturday, 1:15. And real quick, you want to go to all the films or all the, learn more about, get an all festival pass. What do you do, Linda?
OTFF.org.
OTFF.org. Take a look at the menu. They work so hard to bring these fascinating films here, and it's happening now. Have fun with the festival.
I know. It's tomorrow already.
Thank you. Jack Garner, we'll see you Saturday.
I'm going to be there. Well, not just Saturday. I'm going to be there Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
All right. There you go. And Tim George, thank you. Megan Mack, I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon.